and I may never see him again, which is more or less all right with me. He and my brother lost touch some years ago. I wonder where we were going that night. I don't know, but it seemed as if we had the key to the highway. A poem by Mark Halliday, Key to the Highway, from Little Star, published by William Morrow and Company, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Nook, Simple Touch with Glow Light by Barnes & Noble. Designed for bedtime reading, Glow Light offers paper-like reading with the lights on or off. Available at neighborhood Barnes & Noble stores or Nook.com. Produced by Nick Vedder, written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's time for Open Journal's Community Spotlight, where listeners like you produce your own programs. This airtime is a free service offered to those interested in sharing their knowledge, talent, and passions. This is also a space to audition new programming. Opinions expressed in Open Journal may not reflect the views of the Pacifica Foundation, its staff, board, or volunteers. Information shared on Open Journal should not take the place of appropriate professional consultation. Now it's time for Open Journal's Community Spotlight here on KPFT Houston. Hi, and welcome to Community Spotlight. My name is Mike Honig. I do a show called Think Wing Radio, where one of my guidelines is you're entitled to your own opinion, but not your own facts. This weekend was Memorial Day weekend. I hope you all had a great time and that you took a moment to remember why we have a Memorial Day weekend, the reason for the season, as they say. And today, just serendipitously as it turns out in my particular case, is primary election day. We've had a couple of weeks of early election voting, and today is the actual day when you would actually have to go to your polling place. For the people in Harris County, you can go to harrisvotes.com. It might be .org. I apologize. I should have that information at my fingertip. So today we're going to be talking about elections. We're going to be talking about why it's important to vote, why primaries matter at least as much as the general election, and why your one single vote can matter a lot, and you should not just stay home figuring it doesn't. I'm going to have two guests today. One is Professor Bleece Graham. He is currently a visiting professor in the Bush School of Government at Texas A&M. Before moving to Texas, he was a political scientist on the faculty at the University of South Carolina for over 30 years. He is frequently called upon by media, hence me, and community groups to comment on the political scene, especially elections in the South. My second guest is Robert L. Mark, whom we here typically call Bob. He is an attorney by profession, having been the executive director of the Northeast Missouri Legal Services in Hannibal, Mo. From 1984 to 92. He has also been chairing the KPFT local station board for the last 2 years, and he is on the board of trustees of the Watershed United Methodist Church in League City, Texas. So what we really want to discuss today is elections, why they matter, how they matter, why they matter to you. Professor Graham, I guess I should say, are you on the line with me?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Fine.
Just in a nutshell, when did primaries become the preferred means of nominating candidates as opposed to smoke-filled rooms where the party hacks made those choices?
Well, generally primaries are attributed to what's called the progressive era or period in American history from around 1880 to 1920. The idea of using a nominating primary instead of a convention to put candidates on the ballot gained some popularity, and you know, it extends into current times. The primary is not without blemishes, though. In a one-party state, the primary amounts to the general election and can be considered misleading in that regard. But generally speaking, I think primaries have matured, and so while the practice varies by state, many primaries are open, which means that a registered voter shows up, declares Democrat or Republican, and proceeds to vote then on a slate of nominees to name the party's candidates. And I think it's important to think about the primary at least in two stages, depending on the rules in the state. And I think Texas has a majority rule. If you don't get a majority on the first round, there's a runoff that occurs at a specified time later.
Now, you made the point in our prior conversations about how in some circumstances, and I think Texas represents one of those circumstances in many races, that where you have in many places an effectively one-party system, the primary for practical purposes might as well be the general election, and voters and potential voters should view it that way.
I think that's correct, because either there is no opposition in November or else the opposition from the opposite party is more of a token nature, and therefore, while it's, you know, formally on the ballot, it really doesn't have much of a realistic chance of winning an election. So I think of this as an election really is a three-step process. The primary, the potential for a runoff, which may or may not happen, and then the general election in November. And, you know, voter turnout is generally considered to be a sign of a fair election and a healthy democracy. And so turnout in all three of these stages is very important for citizen confidence in government.
Ultimately, heavy turnout, even among people who aren't sure about all the people or issues that they want to vote for, heavy turnout nonetheless tends to dilute narrow, specific interest groups that might vote in greater proportion in their numbers than, let's say, the typical voter, and thereby, in some sense, control the ballot box. One of the things that I kind of pulled up doing a quick search, I wanted to give an example of some interestingly close elections. In Canada, in 1994 and in 2003, in two elections, each one totaling, in one case, 39,000 votes, in one case totaling 34,000 votes, it was a tie. It was an actual tie. They had to have a new election. In the United States Senate in 1974 in New Hampshire, out of 223,400 votes cast, the election was decided by two votes. In Indiana in 1984, 233,300 votes decided by four votes. We had, of course, the election in Minnesota with Al Franken, and there you had, let's see, you had 2,888,000 votes, and it was decided by 312 after swinging back and forth quite a while. Now, Bob Mark here has sort of an interesting personal anecdote about his experience in an election. Bob, would you like to tell us briefly about how that went?
Sure. In 1991, I was an attorney working on a salary in a little town called Hannibal, Missouri, boyhood home of James Earl Ray, by the way, for those of you who are keeping track. It currently has a population of about 18,000 people. I think it was a little more then. But I was actually called upon by the law enforcement community to run against an entrenched incumbent municipal judge, a nonpartisan election, because he was getting up in years, and he would take every case under advisement, and it would get lost in the woods. He would never rule on the cases, and law enforcement was getting frustrated because they had some pretty bad behaviors, and there was no consequences for whenever they would catch them and cite them. And they were looking for anybody to run against this judge, and it was hard to do since there hadn't been a contested judicial election against an incumbent in that county since World War II. So they called upon me, and I agreed to do it, and we went through the election process. And my son actually was the most vested in my winning the election. He walked around to all these communities with me. And on election day, I lost the election by a total of 7 votes.
Well, now, you would have tied with 6 votes, but 7 votes would have won you the election. And by the way, this is KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, just for those who would like to know. So you, essentially, 7 votes would have won you the election, 6 votes would have at least tied it. And what was it people were saying to you after the election that's kind of the punchline to this story?
Oh, I had about 20 people that I had known in the town for years. I moved there in 1981, and I'd known them for years, and they came up to me and they said, "Bob, if we had known you had had a chance, we would have gone out and voted."
Which only goes to show that polls don't matter, votes do. Tell your friends, don't stay home, vote for me.
And I would point out, you know, that the election, it was 2,780 votes. I my rough math calculation, which is better than most people here at KPFT, that's about 15% of the population, which is an even bigger percentage of the voting population.
And the margin of victory for the winner is in the triple decimal digits.
And my point here is that's about twice as much turnout as we had in the Harris County, Houston, City of Houston election.
Yeah, I think we've actually had our light rail system determined by a vote of about that size, and we're a bigger city. So, Dr. Graham, getting back to stories like that, how do you mobilize? Now, we've talked about voter mobilization versus voter motivation, and I think they're subtly different things. Mobilization, I think you think of in terms of a statistical mass number of whom you hope to get a certain fraction out. But getting down to a onesie, how do you motivate a single person who might think that their vote isn't that important to think of their vote as potentially really important?
Well, part of that is the way you run a campaign, and you know, campaigns today get more and more expensive and more complicated, so that voter mobilization really is kind of a get out the vote phenomenon, where either by word of mouth or by other kinds of means, there's a personal contact with the candidate. You know, a text message, a telephone call to be sure and get out to vote. And so, in a national campaign, these things have gotten so sophisticated that you can one can tell, you know, if a potential voter hasn't voted by early afternoon, that you can target that person with a phone call to say, you know, come along, let's get out and vote, or we'll come and pick you up so you can vote. So mobilization is kind of the sum of external influences on potential voters. Voter motivation is more of an internal aspect of what an individual thinks about the value of voting. You can think of it in terms of information cost. In other words, I got to learn a lot about elections. There are so many elections. They go from top to bottom, you know, from nominating a U.S. Senate candidate to the kind of election that Bob is describing on a local level, dealing with a municipal judge. So just learning about what votes coming up is an important part of voter motivation. Then you have all those transaction costs, like it's going to cost me time. I got to be sure my employer will let me off for the 2 hours required to go vote without subtly punishing me somehow. So all of those impediments or barriers to a motivated voter then start to appear, and the result is just a lower turnout.
Well, you really need to inculcate a culture of voting. You have to feel internally guilted that you don't vote in order to really develop those impulses to get people to get out there, to internalize it. We're going to go to a break in just a moment, but you know, I wanted to point out Dr. Graham, Professor Graham, I'm never sure quite which way to go.
Is fine.
Please is fine.
Right.
4.1 million voters approximately 30% of registered voters, 4.1 million voters will go out to vote. 2.8 million in 2008 voted for Democratic candidates. 1.3 million in 2010 voted for GOP candidates. This year, according to Blease, in the Dewhurst versus Cruz race, about 750,000 votes will be needed to win if turnout stays about the same as the 2010 primary. Less than 6% of registered voters. There are a lot of factors that get involved here. Also, he noted 155 GOP delegates are at stake in Texas, which could clinch the Romney nomination. I still think it's going to be an interesting convention.
Right.
I still think it's going to be an interesting convention.
Yes, I think it will be, too.
But voter turnout and primary results is key, and diluting motivated minorities in turnouts is key. I believe we 1 minute away from the traffic break? Okay. So what I would like to do is give out the phone number. If there's anyone out there that would like to discuss elections, primary day, not necessarily specific candidates, but whether you intend to vote, whether you have plans on how to get other people to vote, I'd be most interested. The phone number here is 713-526-5738 or 713-526-KPFT. And after the break, we will take phone calls.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston. And we're coming up on 9:45. Here is a quick look at traffic and weather. There's a heavy truck stalled on I-10, the East Freeway, eastbound at 59, the East Tex Freeway. One ramp lane is affected. And there's slow traffic on 59, the East Tex Freeway, southbound from Quitman to 45. Travel time about 7 minutes at 21 miles per hour. And slow also on the 610 North Loop, westbound from Irvington to Shepherd. Travel time 5.5 minutes at 26 miles per hour. And slow on the I-10 East Freeway, westbound from the 610 East Loop to Lockwood. Travel time about 3 minutes at 40 miles per hour. Current temperature is 81 degrees, and humidity is 77%. Skies are partly cloudy. Today's forecast for Harris County, mostly sunny with a high of 93 and a low of 73 degrees. Please stay tuned after the community spotlight for the 420 Drug War News, followed by Undercurrents at 10 o'clock and then Wide Open Spaces at 11 o'clock. And now back to today's community spotlight, Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig.
Hi, and welcome back. I am Mike Honig. I do Think Wing Radio. I blog at thinkwingradio.com, and I'm joined today by my guests, Professor Blease Graham of Texas A&M University, a visiting professor, and one of KPFT's board members, Bob Mark, having told a story about his election experience. So I believe we have a phone call, which I'd like to take. So, Mark, you are on the air. This is Mike. What would you like to talk about?
My question is, would somebody finally explain how the Electoral College works and why do we still need such a system in today's time?
Those are two questions, one of which is sort of easy and one of which is sort of hard. Dr. Graham, do you want to take that or should I take a shot?
I'll take a start and then you can help me out. The Electoral College provides for the election of the president, obviously, and the election goes by state. And each state is entitled to the number of representatives plus the two senators in terms of Electoral College votes. So if you have, say, three members of Congress and two senators, you have five votes. And there is a total of 538 votes. There are 435 members in the House and 100 senators and three Electoral College votes from the District of Columbia, provided by constitutional amendment. So you need 270 Electoral College votes to win. And it's summed up by state with a couple of exceptions. I think Nebraska allows its Electoral College slate to be split, and maybe the state of Maine, if I remember correctly, but most of the states have a winner-take-all approach, so that if you win the election for the slate in the state, that particular candidate, Democrat or Republican, typically gets all of the Electoral College votes of that state. So we have to have 270.
I think the other part of your question about why do we still have an Electoral College, am I understanding that correctly? Was that the other part of your question, Mark?
Yes.
That obviously is highly debatable. I think that it comes down to the framers had two things in mind. One, of course, they were aristocrats, and a lot of the elected officials that we now take for granted as elected officials used to be either appointed or they were elected by state legislatures. So we never had a one man, one vote. It was always a mixture of powerful people, politicians, and the common man, which was the idea for the House of Representatives. I think that one of the incentives for the Electoral College and one of the reasons that it's persisted in spite of its imperfections is that in a country that is really, really diverse, if you did not have an Electoral College, the argument might go, then the people in the middle of the country would effectively have no voice. The elections would be decided by the population centers on the East Coast, the population centers on the West Coast, and the people in the middle would be rendered irrelevant, which would probably not be a healthy political situation. So, I mean, the system is certainly flawed. I wrestle with it occasionally when I think about politics, about what could you do to make the Electoral College better or eliminate it? Would that be suitable or replace it with something else? But it's one of those things for which there are no easy answers because there are pros and cons, and it's not an arbitrary device politically. It has reasons for existing.
Right. But then, too, the other side is that we encourage other nations and countries to have free and fair elections, but they don't use an electoral college system.
Yeah, there is the do as we say, not as we do.
So
thing.
It's kind of a saying, one side we're hypocrites, but we're on the other side, we're trying to show good measure by having free elections in other countries.
Well, you know, Mark, I appreciate your call. I've got a couple of other gentlemen.
Okay.
You've made a couple of good points, but thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
I am going to go to Baba in Houston. Did I get that right? Baba, you're on the air?
Yes, sir. Good morning.
Hi, how are you? What have you got to talk about?
I'm wondering, I went to vote this morning, but I was surprised there was no competition.
Competition in what sense?
I mean, the primary mostly, you know, I'm not going to say which party I vote for, but most of the judge running, they didn't have anybody running against them.
Well, essentially, candidates like to run in a scenario. This is, again, my opinion. Candidates like to run in a scenario where they have a chance to win. And when you have an incumbent, unless that incumbent has developed some political enemies, or unless you as a challenger have developed some important political allies, it becomes a waste of your time. And running for office is a big investment of time and energy and money and all of those other things. Does that kind of answer your thought?
My thing is, I mean, it's a democracy. Somebody running for judge, I think there should be somebody else equal who can challenge him. Say in the Democratic primary, the same thing as in the Republican primary.
Well, of course, as a democracy, we can't force people to run, but I think Bob has a thought about that.
Yeah, remember in my story, I said that the judge was having some problems with law enforcement. If they had not come to me and asked me to run, I would have never run against a sitting judge, even though it hadn't been done since the 1940s. Because, you know, if you lose, as I did, you got to go practice before these judges. And so I think that you've got to really have some, I will call them stones, to run against an incumbent judge. And it's a very difficult choice to make. And so in those judicial races, you're not going to find a lot of competition. The party, relative parties, are going to pick a candidate they think has the best shot at winning, and they're going to discourage competitive races.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Baba. I appreciate your call. This is KPFT 90.1 FM, Community Spotlight. My name is Mike Honig. I'm doing a show called Think Wing Radio today. And we have Philip from Houston. Philip, hi, this is Mike. You're on the air. What would you like to talk about?
Yeah, I believe that voting is the hallmark of our democracy. And as such, I think we should just make it as for mandatory as, you know, getting licenses or anything else like that, and how much money will we save by not having to roll out the vote, but had everybody voting and participating actively, and then also having a voting, you know, holiday. Hey, you know, we have 2 days of voting. Hey, we're going to vote. Everyone's going to take a voting holiday. We're all going to go vote, you know. You can go absentee. You can go whatever way you want to, or electronic. You can go, you know, show up at the ballot and close the curtains and make your vote.
Did you say mandatory voting?
Yeah.
Mandatory. Well, I feel your pain, but I don't think I agree with your solution. I want to say this, though, when you talk about voting and getting turnout. I discussed this with Bob. I discussed this with Lise. In 2008, my house burned down, and we got out of the house with the clothes on our backs. I mention that story only because I lost my driver's license. I lost my Social Security card. I lost pretty much all my ID. We did manage to save a birth certificate and passport. But had that not been the case, had everything been destroyed in the fire, I would have had a dickens of a time trying to get the identification, to get the identification, to get the identification, to get a voter registration card. Now,
I mean, after Katrina, I mean, I'm surely other people have had catastrophes and you know, everything in their pocket. And yeah, it is a long, hard stroll to get back to where you can identify yourself and get into voting. But I mean, it has to be something. I mean, how often does those things happen? It's
well,
everyday occurrence.
It happens to a lot of people. You know, we have hundreds of millions of people. It happens to tens of thousands of people, maybe hundreds of thousands over a lifetime, a disaster like that. So when you have voter suppression laws, These voter suppression laws do disproportionately hit the poor, but even for someone like myself, I'm middle class, I'm educated, I'm white, I would have had a very, very hard time getting voter ID or even a driver's license because you have this chain of stuff you have to do. It takes time, it takes money. Voting isn't supposed to cost anything. It's supposed to be a right, not a privilege. Driving is a privilege. Voting is a right.
So you have the voting holiday. I mean, you've got 2 days to go ahead and take your, you know, your birth certificate and go to the records and try to obtain all those things. But the proportion of people that don't vote as opposed to people that don't vote because they have an extenuating circumstance like yourself or anybody who was just, you know, recently in a national disaster and lost everything is small, a heck of a lot bigger than the people that have a small crisis or a lost everything, you know. I mean, the people that are participating
I am going to challenge you, and I apologize for cutting you off, but I'm going to challenge you to try to do what you say in 2 days, starting from absolutely nothing. Dr. Graham, do you have anything you'd like to say really quickly to wrap it up?
Oh, I'm just saying that there's a greater portion of people.
Oh, did we lose you?
They're not mandatory to vote, and then there's other portion of people that are a very small portion of people that are not voting because they don't.
Okay, apparently we're losing bits of Dr. Graham, for which I apologize.
I'm here.
You're here.
Yep, yep.
I'm not hearing pieces of you. I'm not sure if you're going out on the air or not. We're getting close to the end. I want to thank you, Dr. Graham, for investing your time on the air and also with me in planning the show. I want to thank Bob Mark in telling his heartbreaking story about how close it can come and voter remorse. You're listening to Community Spotlight, Mike Honig, thinkwingradio.com. Visit the website, and thank you very much for joining us today.
It's the 420.
You have been listening to Open Journal, KPFT's experiment in community-inspired radio. Since 1970, KPFT has been a unique source on the Houston airwaves. Visit KPFT.org to support this station. KPFT listener members are welcome to produce an Open Journal. Prospective producers must fill out an Open Journal request form, which is available at our website. The program director welcomes your feedback on every Open Journal. Listener feedback helps KPFT determine what Open Journals are appreciated by the community at large. To get in touch with the program director, send an email to pd@kpft.org or call 713-526-4000, extension 308. Please stay tuned for Undercurrents coming up at 10, followed by Wide Open Spaces at 11. And thank you for tuning in today to Open Journal here on 90.1 KPFT Houston, Radio for Peace.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following comes to us courtesy of Fox Television.
A college student has filed an $11 million lawsuit against police in central Utah.
He claims they forced a catheter in him when he refused to consent to a search for marijuana.
Ben.
Stephen Cook has filed this lawsuit against a San Pete County Sheriff's deputy and police in Ephraim. Now, he claims he was only smoking cigarettes with his friends, and the police were out of control when they searched them for drugs.
I don't think it's right what they did, and I'm pretty sure they're doing it to other people. You know, it made me feel like an animal.
Stephen Cook says he was smoking cigarettes with his friends. Police claimed to smell marijuana and searched the Snow College students. According to this lawsuit, Cook claims police brought in a canine and still couldn't find marijuana. An officer claimed to have found a glass pipe in the trunk, but then asked Cook, who was a passenger in the car, to drive his friend's car to the police station.
If somebody's under the influence of marijuana, the last thing you want to do is put them in a car and drive. That goes against every statute that the state has. And so that's where it gets a little frustrating, and then it just gets out of control from there.
At the police station, Cook claims he was put in a holding cell, and officers demanded he take a drug test.
And I asked for an attorney, you know, because I didn't know if this was right what they were doing. And so once I did that, they said, well, we're getting a search warrant, so we're going to have your urine by the end of the night.
Police got a warrant and took him to the hospital, where Cook claims they forced a catheter into him to get the urine sample.
The nurse told him to hold my shoulders, so he held my shoulders, and then the nurse undid my pants and wiped me down with iodine and put the tube in me. So And then they took me to jail.
Cook says he was arrested for marijuana possession and resisting arrest for refusing to give that urine sample.
This is being used as a punishment to try and get them to comply. And rather than employing a simple blood test, they're forcibly catheterizing these people.
Absolutely, we deny the allegations.
The lawyer for the police and San Pete County points out that Cook struck a plea deal with prosecutors to the marijuana charge. It allows for the charge to be dismissed if he complies with probation.
Whatever happened to him in terms of the catheterization was done pursuant to a warrant, a bodily fluids warrant issued by a judge, so it was under the auspices of a court order.
I'd like them to be accountable for what they did.
So, Ben, have there been lawsuits similar to this one in the past?
Yes, there was a similar lawsuit that was in neighboring Sevier County. And in that one, a woman alleged that she underwent a forced catheterization. Now, that lawsuit was ultimately dismissed in favor of the police.